Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Myself, Dr. L.S. Chauhan. I am Deputy Director General Health Services, Minister of Health and Family Welfare, Government of India, and Program Manager for TB in India. I have been given this responsibility today by the organizers. I am really thankful for honoring me, and I'll try to do justice to this the job given to me. We like to continue from the morning the experiences from the country in the implementation and the scaling up of the Stop TB strategy. The two important topics for the presentations in this session are empowering patients and communities, as well as engaging all care providers. At the same time, we'll have presentation from the Stop TB partnership ACSM working group, how it can fit to serve the purpose of empowering patients and communities, and as well as perhaps it can play a role also in involving all other care providers also. So we have three presentations, and discussions will be after all presentations. I think so that will be more appropriate rather than going for any question answer for after each presentations. So without because this is very I don't think so this is a new area. Each country by one or other form used to implement its this communication strategy or advocacy, but in the present form, what Stop TB partnership has thought to bring it as one of the component of the strategy to implement it in a focused manner, and that's what is required. And that's what, as in the morning, you must have seen that we are worried about 2005 targets. So the real approach to get that is the involvement of the community and how to involve that. So that's what we are going to discuss in these presentations. I think without wasting time, we should go for the should I introduce the presenters? The first presenter is Mr. K. Scott Gordon, who's from the World Care Council, and also he's representing the communities. And the another who will be presenting on the report from the Task Force on the Community Involvement in the TB Control, Mr. Francis Adatu from Uganda. I'm sorry if my pronunciation is something different, because it's and then Mr. Paul Sommerfeld, who's a chair of the ACSM working group, going to present how it can fit in the job. And then Jan Wasken from KNCV. So after these four presentations, we'll have the discussions. So I'll request the first presenter, Mr. K.S. Gordon from the World Care Council, to please.
Thank you, Doctor. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is K.S. Gordon. I'm a former MDR patient. I'm still around. Through the process, I won't tell you about it, but through the long process, I began to become aware that people with tuberculosis, living with tuberculosis, or who've had tuberculosis, need to begin to organize, need to begin to participate, need to begin building bridges with their healthcare providers, need to begin to understand what treatment is all about, within that, what their responsibilities are, and within that, what their rights should be as well. Over the last couple of years, in fact, this is a bit of a birthday in some respect. 2 years ago, I think tomorrow, Dr. Phil Hopewell, who's sitting over there, came up to me and asked me if I wanted to be involved in the writing committee of what would ultimately become the new International Standards for Tuberculosis Care. And it sounded a little bit interesting until he said three magic words. He said, "We're going to try to take a patient-centered approach." Right away, I said, "Yes." I had been reading up on tuberculosis for a few years prior to that while popping my pills and feeling rather ill, but when I heard a patient-centered approach, I decided that this was very much an approach that was worth pursuing. To make a long story short, I began getting involved with this the writing committee for the standards, and also at the same time began realizing that the methodical approach that Phil was taking was indeed good. that we, as members of the community, people who are on treatment, we too needed to begin to develop our own systems, our own tools. Out of all of that came an idea to develop a document that would be our own. Nice and big, eh? I like that one. We had the idea of doing a charter of our rights and our responsibilities. The two words actually go hand in hand as charter and standards. But we didn't want to write it ourselves, and so we started putting out calls. There's a few of my colleagues here, and I'll introduce you in a minute. We put out basically calls to draft. We asked people around the world to send in ideas, to send in what you felt, what you thought would be or should be your right, and what is your responsibility. We did that about 7 times, many drafts, and over just about 1,000 people from all over the place sent in little emails, snippets of paper, recipes, and everything else. And we synthesized them over many months. Over the last year, the patient's charter and the standards have been slowly moving along towards being discussed, adopted, approved, stamped. And now we're looking at implementation. Very nice photo, very nice words. But they don't serve anything unless we begin to actually work with you folks here to make what's in here and in the standards happen. And it's not just saying, oh, this is good, we'll do it. It's sitting down and developing in each country and in each community a methodical approach to get this into reality. Nice words won't happen unless we work together. What is in here, we feel, the communities, is just that, a tool to begin to reach out to the providers, to the clinicians, to all of you, to sit down at a table and figure out how together we can implement the standards and the charter. They're tandem documents. To do so, there's a few people here I'd like to perhaps stand up. Folks, can we just stand on up? I'm going to pass the microphone to a couple of them. These are some of my colleagues from around the world. We've all been through TB treatment. When they've all heard or became involved with the charter, they all said, yes, this is something we can work with in my community, in my village, in my town. And they began to organize in their communities. I'm now going to pass the microphone to two of them who will give you a little bit more insight from their communities, from their country. But all of us would like to reach out to you and ask over the next couple of days if we can sit down and drink some coffee, some tea, have whatever, and start talking about how concretely in each country we can begin to promote and implement this document with the standards. The two go together. And we need to make sure that this happens. If we're going to reach some of the goals in the global plan and make element 5 of the Stop TB strategy more than just nice words, we need to work at it. And we'd like to do this with you as partners. I thank you, and I'd like to pass the mic to Nizu and Steve. They'll introduce themselves a little bit more in detail. And I thank you very much, and I'll pass not only the mic, but the charter. Thank you again.
Good afternoon. My name is Nitsa, and I come from Nagaland, which is a small state in the far northeast corner of India at the border of Burma. Professionally, I'm a trainer in conflict transformation. And our region, which is very closely connected with China, Nepal, Tibet, Burma, Bangladesh, and Bhutan, as you know, has an extremely high prevalence of TB. This is so because of the precarious mountainous terrain and extreme mobility of the population. We have huge problems with drug addiction, as we are an important transit point for heroin trafficking. We also have a history of 56 years of armed conflict, which has resulted in militarization, excessive human rights abuse, and displacements of people. My work as an NGO consultant has given me the opportunity to travel to different situations in the world in setting up HIV care projects. And while I was working with the Australian Aboriginal people in Central Australia, I was found to have acquired TB. Fortunately, I was detected TB in Australia, and I managed to go through an extremely very excellent medical health care. But it was also a traumatic experience for me because this TB treatment hampered my visa processes, and it was a difficult experience. When I returned home to Northeast India, I found that most people have TB, but would never talk about it. They were suffering silently and fearfully. So I began to engage myself fully in advocacy, particularly to reduce stigma and fear, and advocacy also for setting up services in places where it was most needed. I believe very strongly that active participation and involvement of TB-affected and infected communities is the way forward, not just in addressing TB and its related issues, but in making TB program work in the ground. To me, empowerment of these communities is not about mobilizing them so that they come and access services that we create. It is not about having them appear in posters and in IEC materials. It is not about having them come and share their life stories in meetings such as this. To me, empowerment of communities means engaging them in critical dialogues, creating space for them to ask difficult questions, and drawing from them solutions to those questions. It means communities demanding services rather than receiving services. It means communities involving in monitoring the quality of services, and even to the extent of communities running services themselves. And I believe that the first step forward in achieving this ambitious goal is adopting and implementing the patient's charter in the real sense, right there in the ground, not just in significant events like these meetings. And to do this, I and others like me have a role to play. And I want to just encourage you and remind you that we want to be actively involved, not just in implementation of your programs, but in designing and planning your programs and work with you hand in hand in the ground so that our collective dream of making this world a TB-free world will become real in our lifetime. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Steve Amolo Amolo. I come from a very small country in the East African part of the world known as Kenya. I'm here on behalf of TB patient community organization known as Alliance for Care and Prevention of TB in Kenya. Probably one of its own in eastern part of Africa, if not the whole of Africa, simply because I've never had any other TB patient organization really doing that much work and recognized by a body like this. First of all, let me expressly thank the outgoing and incoming national TB program managers in Kenya, Dr. Chakaya and Dr. Sitinei, respectively, for giving us support to bring up this kind of organization, which has really stayed for a long period of time before coming to realization. They are very much understanding, and I want to say thank you very much. Secondly, I'd want to thank my sponsors to this conference. It came as a dream because I never knew I will get this opportunity to come to France. Getting visa from my country to France is a nightmare. But, and particularly to a very small community member. But thanks that I made it, and I'm here today with you to listen to me. Having heard from what my colleague has said, I will not go back to that. What I would want to say is that we, as the community affected by this disease, we appreciate the steps and the way forward that Stop TB Partnership is putting in place. For the strategy to work, I want to believe that there are a few things that must be also put in place. Besides just strengthening the infrastructure, focusing on the laboratory, and so on and so forth, we believe that we need to develop the capacity of the communities that are receiving the care that we are talking about. You all know that there is no any program that can benefit if the community consuming that kind of service are not informed. We believe if the TB community, who are the consumers of these services, are left behind, then for sure this strategy will just but remain here as a word of mouth. The TB community offers you a three-pronged approach. One is to develop the infrastructure that will ensure that TB care is done according to the standards. Two, we need to see TB patient organizations evolving right from the grassroots upwards, because it is on that background that we are going to realize that what you are doing has a meaning. We have to know, make sure that the TB patient understand what TB treatment is. If you have forever to dream that you can fight against MDR-TB or to the worst, XDR-TB. Thirdly, we want to envisage proper linkages and referral systems developed between the communities and the healthcare providing facilities, because such kind of linkages and referrals will ensure that we don't lose people who are on treatment. We know very well there is a lot of stigma around TB, and unless this is addressed, then we are here for no purpose at all. It is therefore imperative that formation of TB community organizations be encouraged and all strengthened in the countries where they already exist. Why do we talk of TB patient organizations? One, we know it is important for doing the local advocacy around TB at the national levels. Two, such organization will call for increased national and international response to control TB, because so many governments append their signatures on declarations, but they don't implement. Three, these organizations can take local advocacy to higher levels to ensure resources for TB care and prevention become available. I remember in yesterday's breakaway sessions, when it came to a session where empowerment of patient community came about, and people were asked to give what they do in their own countries, I remember, and I'm so sorry with all the due respect, that there was none that could come up and say, we are doing this with this kind of organization. I think if it not to blow our own trumpet, it's only Kenya that actually talked about something like that. I'd want to encourage all the national TB program leaders here that it is important that you involve TB community very meaningfully. We believe these organizations will ensure every clinician treats TB cases with all the respect it deserves. It will enhance case findings and adherence to TB treatment, and thus reducing the risk of developing resistance. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to bore you with a lot of words, but what you are trying to say today, when I came from Kenya, they told me, tell that conference that ACT Kenya is a TB community organization back here, which is crawling. Let's stop TB partnership, WHO, World Care Council, take support of this, and let us show up as an example. Thank you very much.
Thank you all participants who for sharing the experiences and talking about the patient charter, their rights, their responsibilities, and the importance for the involvement of these patients in the designing and planning the activities for the TB control, their involvement, the importance. Thank you. So I'd like to invite the next presenter now, Dr. Francis Adetu for Uganda. Again, he will talk about the, he'll present the report from the task force on community involvement in TB control.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I must say I was listening with a lot of excitement, because a few weeks back when we were in Milan, we took a shot at this subject, and we struggled with a lot of terms. I am very happy in the way the terms are being used today. Communities affected by tuberculosis. organizations of persons affected by tuberculosis so that we send the signal out correctly. Because it's been said, the public health professionals alone with their TB experts and governments might not have the solution to the TB problem until and when they involve the communities affected. So I listened with a lot of interest, and I thank CASE for packaging this. We had a few arguments in Milan, but I want to publicly announce that it seems we are moving on the same direction. So my simple task this afternoon is to present to you the report from the Task Force on Community Involvement in TB Care and Prevention. Okay. The background to this presentation is this. You are all aware of what was shown today or this morning, that there is now a new Stop TB strategy which was launched in March on the World TB Day 2006. And the mandate to this was given during the first SCSM meeting, subgroup meeting at country level last year, a joint effort of WHO and the Stop TB Partnership. There was wide representation of relevant constituencies during this first meeting, and indeed in the subsequent meeting in Milan, patients, community representatives from grassroots level, CSOs involved, NGOs, NTPs, and other WHO departments involved in similar work, namely the HIV/AIDS department. The objectives of this task force meeting were three: to reach consensus on the terminology used to describe the initiatives aimed at establishing partnership with the communities. There were a lot of words shared therein, and many times we discovered the words meant different things to different people in the room. Three was to present the results of the review of community involvement in TB control and discuss emerging issues. A review was conducted, as I will shortly show, in 7 countries. Three is to build consensus on a draft guidelines on promotion of community involvement in the TB control. I must hasten to add that there is actually a demand both from the NTPs and the communities affected for direction in which to move so as to complement the already made efforts. The methodology chosen was a series of country reviews conducted: Bangladesh, Indonesia, Kenya, Malawi, Mexico, Philippines, and Uganda. There was also literature reviews on issues related to patient empowerment in TB control and community involvement in TB control. Above summarized and discussed in a concept paper which was disseminated to all the task force members before the meeting in Milan. Then consensus building on recommendations as a joint effort by all task force members. The process was as follows. The Milan meeting, following circulation of the concept paper, had to reach consensus on broad recommendations. And mark the word broad, because we are leaving it a little open for each and everyone to be able to slot in what would be worthwhile. Two, in order to speed up the process, it was agreed that forming of a writing committee would suffice. Workshop aimed at finalizing the first draft of the final document is to be conducted 8th to 10th November this year. Then the email-based finalization of the document by task force members. I've been following through email. Many have signed up for this, which means the subject must be of great interest to many. Then endorsement by the Advocacy, Communication and Social Mobilization subgroup of the partnership at country level and at the STAG subgroup. The final document will focus on the following main areas. One, it should clearly identify the target audience, which is NTPs, and what we traditionally call partners, which is civil society, patients and patient groups, local community, and whoever else participates in TB control. Number two, the document will also take cognizance of overarching principles with the clear definitions therein, the issues of subsidiarity, the issues of sustainability, the issues of empowerment and the local ownership. I think everybody in this room is aware that ACSM is one of the weakest arm of many programs, and we have been taking single shots maybe once a quarter, and I'm advised ACSM should be like climbing stairs until you reach the top. There are issues like human rights and individual responsibility, social justice, solidarity, addressing stigma, all have to be embodied and reflected clearly in this coming guide. Then there are issues related to partnerships with patients, local community, civil society at different levels. No one size fits it all in line with the flexibility of the MDGs. Final document, main areas of focus continued. It will be policy guidance for NTPs, developing or revising current NTP policies to include component 5 of the Stop TB partnerships, clearly elaborating actions and clearly elaborating principles to be adopted therein. The next is advocacy, ACSM, preparing strategy and operational plan for component 5 with specific behavioral objectives and targets. Again, actions and principles based therein. Building capacity for component 5 and all other relevant areas for quality of TB control. While we do all this, we must not derail the cardinal elements which determine a quality TB program. Developing IEC and BCC strategy, methodologies, and materials for different levels and stakeholders. Those of you who are program managers like me, you know how attractive IEC areas are. But if you are not careful, all the resources will go there and you'll remain with nothing to treat the patients. Last bullet is approaches to component 5 need to take into account special challenges which are obtaining now, specifically TB-HIV. You realize this morning, Chris Dye's presentation said there is little funding going towards TB-HIV. But world over, everybody says TB is the leading killer of HIV/AIDS clients, and this is not followed with attendant resources. Now we have the problem of MDR, and indeed XDR. We have the problem of indigenous populations, their movements and lifestyles. We have the special communities like prisons, IDPs, and refugees. This has to be put in context if we are to fully engage communities in TB control. There is the issue of ensuring quality of service delivery. Ensuring quality of a broad range of services provided at community level, actions and principles. As I say, no one size fits all. There needs to be a rethink at country level as to what you prioritize and what you put on the ground and with whom. We have a problem of briefcase NGOs. When we reviewed the directory in Uganda, there were over 3,000 NGOs, all of them with addresses. But when we reached a very good percentage of them, they were not there. Then there is a need to establish M&E, a strong monitoring and evaluation system, which would enable us help to plan effectively for Plan 5, and Component 5, and should be embodied in Component 5. The issues related to budgeting and financing. ACSM has always been aligned in many NTPs or country plans, but I want to assure you there is very little expertise in many programs to budget for this. It's a heavy cost item, and indeed I'm very happy that there is now an ACSM group in the Stop TB partnership. This must be followed by attendant operational research to inform policy and inform drawing of the guidelines, so that we answer general or context-specific questions which relate to community involvement. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the report. Now what I am presenting to you is the timeline for finalizing the document. As I said, there's a meeting of the writing committee scheduled early next month to try and come up with a first draft. Then the draft will be circulated for comments among the task force and ACSM at country level, and we expect the comments therein by mid-December 06. We hope to achieve endorsement of this document by ACSM subgroup at country level by mid-January 07. Then circulation to STAG subgroup for discussion by mid-January also. STAG endorsement by end of January and final editing and publication by the end of February 07. As I said earlier, ladies and gentlemen, there is a demand for this document to guide community involvement so that we and those who have just spoken before me work in harmony for the common good of the patient. Let's give TB a human face. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Francis, for presenting such a comprehensive report of the task force. And now I'll invite the next presenter, Dr. Paul Sommerfeld, who is the chair of the ACSM working group, to discuss how this working group can fit into the purpose.
First of all, before I start my own talk, I've been asked to make an announcement to avoid a confusion that may be happening. Apparently, somewhere in some of the programs about this conference, the main Congress, it is suggested that the Treatment Action Group meeting, which is happening tomorrow, has been cancelled. To avoid any confusion, it has not been cancelled. That's what I've been asked to say. There really is a meeting of the Treatment Action Group, to which many of us I know have been invited, and that it is taking place in the Hotel Meridian all day tomorrow over the road there from 9 o'clock. So if you see anything to the contrary, forget it. I've been given this opportunity to talk about where we are today with the working group on this great mouthful of a title, Advocacy, Communication and Social Mobilization, which not surprisingly we translate as we're talking into the brief initials ACSM. And one of the things I hope I'm going to be able to do in the next few minutes is to be able to clarify what this strange, magical sounding list of initials means. And particularly because we are, you know, we believe that we're the newest working group engaged within the partnership. We only started at the beginning of last year. We believe as a working group we now have considerable impetus. But we are conscious that particularly when we are talking about work at country level, that what is advocacy, social mobilization, communication has still not been fully integrated into the way in which national programs are thought about and planned. We believe that as much as you talk about the need for laboratory services as being essential to a decent national program, communication and social mobilization activities are just as important. Now I've got to try and find out which I... The mouse. Sorry, I was told something else would work, but... Right. First of all, a problem of terminology. I'm afraid our working group... with our working group, you get a body which lumps together in its title three terms which everybody has their own view of what the phrases mean. So I want to tell you what I think they mean. And I hope that they will be understandable to you as well in a similar way. When we're talking about advocacy, we're talking about persuading decision makers. Often that means governments, but not only, of the importance of TB action. We're persuading people who control resources that TB is important. When we talk about communications, we're talking about using the media in all its forms to engage everybody, to inform, persuade, generate action among all people. Sometimes it may be particular target groups, but it can in a country be the total public about what is TB. Thirdly, social mobilization is about the active engagement, and I stress the word empowering, of the community in the fight against TB. Now, sometimes that will mean, if I put it in a slightly simpler way, when I personally am talking about advocacy, I'm usually talking about trying to persuade somebody to open their purse strings and make some money available. When I'm talking about communication and social mobilization, I'm talking about the social aspects of action against this nasty disease. I'm talking about the social aspects of national programs. Within our group, the working group on ACSM, in effect, you have two linked working groups. Firstly, one half of us are concerned with global advocacy. Very evidently, that is essentially about the small little task, to, if the global plan is to be met, of finding an extra $56 billion over the course of the next 10 years, which translates as the little task of finding only $3 billion extra every year. Now, we do not see our job as being one of fundraisers in the sense of writing lots of applications to places, but we do see our function as being the generation of political action which will help to soften up potential donors to either give more than they already do or to come into the market. In the case of some, we believe there are some significant donors potentially who could be engaged in TB and who are not. On the country level side, we're concerned to introduce evidence-based, I stress evidence-based, we're talking about hard data, robust strategies for society and behavioral change and action at national, local, regional and community levels that will ensure access to treatment and care for all, especially the poor, vulnerable and hard to reach populations. That's what we believe we are about. We have within the global plan, there are some specific figures about what we think we are trying to do. So we're saying that by 2010, there will be TB advocacy organizations or coalitions active in at least 20 donor countries and 40 endemic countries. And that by 2015, by the end of the plan period, we will have done what is necessary to get that extra $56 billion. At country level, we certainly believe that by the end of the 10-year period, ACSM methodology should be fully developed and an implemented component of Stop TB strategy. In other words, it will be a normal, automatic, incorporated part of TB programs at global, national, and local level. And I would stress the one little bullet, sort of sub-bullet point here. As a step towards this target, we are hopeful and encouraging all endemic countries by the end of next year to have carried out an ACSM needs assessment from which a country 10-year strategy can be developed. We also believe by the end of the plan period that we will have advocacy organizations operating in a whole range of donor and endemic countries. Why bother? What do we actually think we're trying to do? With all this advocacy, communication, social mobilization, it comes down to, particularly at country level, it comes down to case detection and helping maintain patients on treatment through the period of treatment. If you engage communities, you get the messages about tuberculosis out through communities, that is a way to lengthen the arm and the impact of national programs. That is the way in which you will help people to come forward, to present themselves as potential patients. It will also help dramatically to combat stigma and discrimination in communities, because it becomes an issue which is being openly discussed, properly presented, with the correct messages attached. It is a route to empower people who themselves are affected by the disease. they are going often to be the best communicators and social mobilizers that you have available to you. Whoops, sorry. No, I'm not sure I know how to get this to go back, but I just wanted to stress that obviously the last bullet point was also about saying ACSM is about mobilizing resources. Our working group has gone through a period of restructuring over the course of the last 3 or 4 months. And I just want to tell you where we are at the moment. This working group comprises some 162 individuals whose names are on our list at the moment from all over the world. And between them, they represent some 90 different organizations. Normal working groups just get one core group. We let ourselves have two. So we have one core group for that country level activity and another core group for the global advocacy. And so far we have some 9 task forces that either have recently been formed or have been drawn into the working group, including the most recent one on communication issues associated with all of the XDR story. And I'm very happy that the two previous speakers who've just preceded me gave you reports from 2 of those 9 task forces. I'm not sure how legible this is going to be at the back of the room, but this is our current organigram. If I just try and use the pointer facility here, this gives you, I hope, more clearly the fact that this is a group with 2 halves to it, 2 sides. Each side has a core group. Each side has some specific task forces. So you've just heard from the one on community-based care. Francis Adato has just given you a report from them. And Case Gordon gave you a report from this group a few moments ago. On this side, we have task forces on media and events. That means in providing materials for training of, enhancing media journalistic activity around TB, and also focusing attention on particular events as they occur. Business engagement, concerned with increasing the private sector involvement, commercial sector involvement in TB activity. And we have at the moment small groups looking at issues about getting messages through the G8 meetings, and trying to make sure that the European Commission starts spending much more like its fair share of contribution to the TB needs. But we also have some 3 groups which cross those 2 halves. One group which is about building national partnerships, stop TB partnerships in countries, both in donor and in high burden countries. They, incidentally, are having a meeting working on the development of a handbook on how to do it. They're meeting here tomorrow in the morning. And then there is, I'll come back to them in a moment, it's the most important, but there is also the one on XDR, which has been most recently come out of the meeting only 2 weeks ago that was held in Geneva on developing action against XDR. But coming back to this task force, throughout all of our work, we see it as extremely important to have very full patient advocate engagement. But we also have been very concerned that patient advocates should not be sort of iconic members helping to give a fig leaf of respectability to all the other activities. They should also be engaged in real activity, a real job of work, where they can be most effective. And that is especially true of the area of national advocacy. In other words, in high burden and endemic countries, becoming engaged in persuading the governments in those countries to provide the resources necessary and to give the priority that will support the national programs in being able to do the job of work that they are there to do. We have seen a fairly rapid increase over the last 2 years of on the country level side of our activities. So where 4 years ago there were only 2 countries that claimed to have an ACSM activity within their national program, we now know of at least 19. Similarly, 4 years ago, there were only a couple of programs that had got anything out of the Global Fund, but now through rounds one and notably round five, we're now up to some 18 countries which are about to receive grants from the Global Fund. The 18, by the way, should not be equated exactly with the 19 in the previous slide. This group is some haven't yet started, but they're about to get monies. And not all of these 18 are high burden countries. But what is important here is the method of action of the working group, that on the country level side, my good friend Roberto Tapia, the vice chair, and Tad Penas in the secretariat, organized a number of seminars to assist national program officers understand what we're talking about with social mobilization, etc., and to prepare bids to the Global Fund. So there was a tutoring post process which has paid off. We obviously, like everybody else here, is waiting to hear exactly how successful we have been in round six. But we are optimistic that by sometime late tomorrow, when the news comes to us, that figure of 18 will be notably larger than it looks today. Some of those who were successful in round five were Indonesia, with a budget over a couple of years of some $9 million. Nigeria, a $7 million budget for ACSM activity, Zimbabwe, Bangladesh, Democratic Republic of Congo, Brazil, and the Gambia. I find it rather interesting, actually, that the Gambia, which is, relatively speaking, a small country, gets 0.8, almost as much as Brazil, which must be about 100 times bigger than the Gambia. But I'm sure we will be working on that in years to come. Go over again some of the task forces, and particularly to say one of the roles of our working group is to encourage effective interaction between all the many people around the world who are involved in advocacy. We're very conscious that there are lots of good advocates doing lots of good things, but we don't always know what each other is doing. And so we are developing a new website which you can reach by going on to the Stop TB website and find your way through to ACSM, and you will find a very nice new website which increasingly will have some very interesting and effective information on it. And that links also with our task force on media events led by Tim France and Ronald Kayanja. And they will be likely to be leading to lots of activity here around supporting more media and more effective and more coordinated media activity around TB-related events and stories. Business engagement I talked about, but it's worth mentioning that it is being done in conjunction with the World Economic Forum. It is François Bonici from the World Economic Forum who is leading our task force on business engagement. So we're looking forward to a lot more interaction with the big commercial sector. Building national partnerships, I mentioned, and here you see the website of Stop TB Canada. But within that task force, there are bodies from both donor and recipient countries. That gives you some idea of our targets for all of us. I'm afraid it's slightly out of date. There should be one woman in there. Angela Merkel from Germany should be in that picture, and I think we seem to have found a rather old library picture of the G8 leaders. But that bunch are the people from whom we will liberate our 56 billion, or most of it. And now I come again to stress yet again the importance of that task force in the middle of my organigram, which says that patient advocacy is extremely important not just as making the right noises from time to time and being a little bit of a gadfly to our own debates, but also important as being the best placed people to undertake work to persuade their own governments of the need. And I won't share with you today anything about their terms of reference. They're in the midst of being developed. But we have already two patient vice presidents of the working group, Dario Abarker and Bertrand Campour, and they are now in the process of putting this national advocacy group together. And I stress it will be in the middle of our working group, relating to both sides, so it will be treated as a task force, both of the country level and of the global advocacy aspects of our work, as well as having their own particular job of work to give a new impetus to national advocacy activity. So lastly, if some of this has made you feel interested, don't feel shy about joining the working group on this wonderful mouthful, advocacy, communication, and social mobilization. And if you send an email to that address, or if you can find her during this conference, grab Carol Francis, please do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Paul, for such a nice and detailed presentations, and with a core and touching message, that is, let us give the importance to the ACSM activities as we are giving the importance to the lab activities. That's important. So I'll request now Mr. Jan Voskan from KNCB to present on engaging all care providers, an approach to health system strengthening. Mr. Jan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. After having heard about the perspective from the patient's view and the community view, I would like to share also the perspective of the other providers. I'm a bit too... what is the reason why we are going to involve all those providers? What is the terms of reference, and why are we going to do that? I will also discuss a little bit about the current status of the public-private partnerships in focusing on Southeast Asia, also about results, achievements, and also the barriers. What has been developed as an answer to the barriers that we experience in expanding the public-private mix? Then, what are the lessons learned for health system strengthening involving other providers in TB control? And lastly, I would like to talk about the plans and the next steps for public-private partnerships. If we ask patients where they go for treatment when they experience symptoms of TB, they are not all going to the NTP, the National TB Program. Many of them go to other providers, and this is clearly illustrated by the findings of the prevalence survey in Indonesia a few years ago, where it was found that patients, except for going to the health center where the NTP is positioned, they also go to hospitals, and they also go to private practitioners. They also go to informal providers, which are not put in this picture, but it is clear that patients go at many providers outside the NTP. It is also clear that this is one country where you can see there's a difference between the different parts of the countries, like Sumatra, the Eastern Islands, and Java, which is highly populated, where patients tend to go to hospitals. In the Eastern Islands, most people go to public health centers because the access is better. Who are the private and the public partners? In China and Indonesia, these are mainly hospitals. Many patients go to hospitals. 50% of patients started treatment in hospitals. There are also private providers which are not organized, and they are in huge numbers. It is India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Philippines, and other countries. Medical colleges, they are big providers in India. Most of the countries also have NGOs that provide TB services for patients. Then, of course, the corporate sector, the businesses, the workplaces, the big factories where many workers are working and suffering from TB, but are not diagnosed and not treated. Then there are the other public providers, like the other ministries, the prisons, the health insurance facilities in India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, and the Philippines. They all do different things. This is a task mix that is developed by the PPM subgroup, where you can see that the different providers can do different tasks. Like, for instance, the NTP is responsible for not only for the clinical functions, but also for the public health functions. The public or private PPM DOS agency can do most of the activities, except the drug supply and the stewardship. Then the individual private physicians and the hospitals, they provide the clinical care, but usually cannot do the public health functions like the tracing and the recording, reporting, etc. The private or public laboratories, they have also a limited function in the TB program, and it has to be defined for every provider separately what they can do best. Engaging the care providers is one of the major components of the Stop TB strategy, not only focusing on number four, but actually to all the elements of the Stop TB partnership, Stop TB strategy, empowering people with TB, AIDS, HIV, and communities, but also contributing to the health system strengthening. Actually, it also addresses number two and number one. We will focus this presentation on Southeast Asia because most of the initiatives regarding public-private partnerships have been undertaken here. The PPM situation in member countries is different. In India, Indonesia, Myanmar, Nepal, the national policy also already includes public-private partnerships, and they're already scaling up the initiatives. In Bangladesh, the policy is in place, and there's a widespread involvement of NGOs, and several pilots already started to involve PPs. In Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Timor-Leste, they are still in a very early stage. And Bhutan, Maldives, actually, there are no drugs in the private sector available, so PPM is not an issue. What has been the public health impact of PPM so far? From the pilot projects in this region, we have seen a very, very good success. The quality of care has improved a lot. Success rates are in general above the 85%. Also, the case detection has increased between 10 to 50%. From studies done in Bangalore and in Myanmar, it turns out that PPM also reaches the poor. It is not often assumed that only the rich people go to private providers, but it seems that also the poor are going to private providers because they are nearby and easy accessible. And 50% of the patients in the Bangalore study were from the lower socioeconomic strata. In Myanmar, it was two-thirds of the patients treated by the private GPs were from the poor groups. There's also considerable financial protection. When there is public-private mix, when the private providers are included in the DOTS program, there's a $50 to $100 reduction for patients for treatment because they would have spent it in the private sector, buying drugs, also paying consultation fees to the specialist. So having PPM has a huge impact on the health condition. This is an example from Indonesia. It just illustrates the success if you have a good public-private mix in place. Here you see a patient with a treatment observer next to her, a private specialist supported by a DOTS team consisting of district and provincial and even national NTP staff. Often there is the question, is it cost-effective? Because many people consider PPM to be expensive. There have been done some studies, mainly led by Catherine Floyd, on PPM in India, Philippines, and South Africa. And it was found there that the PPM is clearly cost-effective. It is affordable, and compared to treatment providers through the NTP, with similar or lower cost per patient treated, and also similar or better cost-effectiveness. This is the evidence that we can use for advocacy to decision-makers. There are many funding sources for public-private partnerships. First of all, it should be there from the government or the ministries, although their contribution is still very low. From Global Fund, that's a big opportunity that we have. Fidelis, TBCAP now, bilateral donors like USAID and SIDA, national and international NGOs, and of course the corporate sector. Not all of these sources are being used so far because there has to be done a lot of advocacy. The challenges for public-private partnership. I think the main issue is that both sectors have a low level of trust. There's a kind of fear of working together because NTPs are often worried that working together with private sector will compromise their program. And there's also a problem between the approaches between the private providers, which often have a clinical view on TB, and the public health perspective that NTP managers and NTP staff have. There seems to be also a problem in scaling up the successful projects, pilot projects that have been started in several countries. And the biggest challenge, I think, is how to invest in the human resources, because the numbers are enormous. If you look, for instance, only in Indonesia, where you have the private providers, more than 200,000 or 300,000, they are not even known. In a big country like India, it will even be more. So the investments that have to be made are considerable. But we have no choice, because from the discussion this morning, it is clear that we have to be ready for the MDR that is being sourced mainly by the private sector, because they are not doing the dots as we would like to do them. This illustrates the different views of the clinicians in the private sector and the public health workers. They're talking often different languages. They often do not hear each other, and maybe it's a matter of communication that has to be started before we can involve other providers. The barriers to public-private partnership expansion that were identified in the third subgroup meeting of the PPM group, there seems to be a lack of commitment from NTPs to start with, to embark on public-private partnerships. There's also limited capacity. People do not know how to do it. There's lack of staff. There's no time. They're already busy enough with DOS expansion. Motivation is often low. And many people in NTP do not know how to deal with private providers because they are from a different world. There's also a lack of tools, lack of guidelines. There were lack of training materials and training tools, and also how to advocate to the other sectors was not known by that time. Also brought forward the lack of technical assistance, the lack of technical support available to support countries in starting up pilot projects. This was all identified during a subgroup meeting last year, 2005. What has been done by the subgroup, what has been done by the people working in the countries on public-private partnerships? The tools and guidelines that have been developed as a response to the barriers. Of course, we have the Stop TB, the global plan. We have the Stop TB partnership that talks about public-private partnership, but it will not help you or the people in the field to start. We have the TBCAP technical application, also a considerable part on public-private partnerships. We have documents from WSO PPM projects and PPP subgroup reports. It's not enough. We need more. We have now, since the beginning of this year, a concise document that explains the generic steps, the generic guidelines, what should be done to initiate a public-private partnership. And a very powerful tool developed by Phil Hopewell in his group, the international standards of TB care that expectedly will be the key to open the door to many sectors, in particular the specialists and the private providers that have a different concept on TB control. And lastly, we have the document engaging all public and private care providers in tuberculosis control that has been that came out, I think, recently last week. We also have a tool in development. It's called the National Situation Analysis Tool to map the providers and to give a picture on what should be done in a country to initiate a public-private partnership. I think also a very important tool will be the planning and budgeting tool that is currently being developed by Catherine Floyd and has been pilot tested. I think these are all very important tools to at least plan and involve the other sectors in the health system. What are the lessons for health system strengthening from the public-private partnership so far? The generic constraints in health system, we all know, there's a health resource crisis, lack of staff, and the big challenge, how can we involve all the other sectors, all the other workers that are there and ready to help, but not yet able to do so because they are not yet linked up to the program. We have weak governance and stewardship of Ministry of Health, especially vis-à-vis the private sector. Many providers are alienated from the public health responsibilities. They do the clinical thing, but they do not report, and they do not trace patients when they drop out. And still, patients waste a large part of the limited resources on poor quality health care. These are all general constraints that are faced by the health system. And I think that from our PPM experiences so far, we have valuable lessons that could also be used for HIV, malaria, and other disease control programs. First of all, how to build capacity in the public sector to engage the private and other providers. For instance, the situation analysis tool that I just mentioned, the practical approaches to map providers, also the management frameworks to involve other sectors, how to do it, what are the steps necessary to approach another provider and to get involved in the TB control program. Also, proper compensation systems, because when they are involved, they also need to compensate for the work they do. The second lesson learned is the sensitization of private and other providers to take on public health tasks, including surveillance, like the standardized recording and reporting system. Another lesson is the improved linking and referral system that has been developed in countries for patients, for instance, detected in hospitals, then being referred for treatment to clinics. The standardized quality care services at low cost across the health systems. I think these are all very important lessons that are valuable for health system strengthening. What are the plans and next steps? The last slides of my presentation. First of all, there's clearly a need for more technical assistance for PPM country planning, because many countries are still struggling to develop a work plan and design the strategic steps, the operational plan to involve other providers. Therefore, we need development of a generic PPM strategy and operational guidelines. They cannot be detailed because the situation in every country will be different and in every situation will be different. But at least there are some generic steps that could be used by program managers. And this can be based on the documents that I just mentioned a few slides before. Then the next thing to do is to develop national PPM strategies and guidelines. Another activity that is planned for the near future is the planning workshop in the region. There will be a planning workshop for the M region and the African region in February next year. And of course, advocacy for public-private mix to catalyze wider implementation. And this is mainly directed to the decision makers. The second thing is the human resource development. I already explained that we need to involve much more people. The numbers are enormous, and therefore, we need to make a plan. More staff is needed. We need focal plans, focal points for public-private mixed activities. We need external TA. Regional training for focal points and national PPM consultants. There's a PPM consultant course planned for April 2007 in Sonderlo early next year that will at least deliver some consultants to provide the technical assistance. But then the next challenge is to train all the NTP staff on interacting with the partners at the operational level. The third thing to do, the third thing in the planning, is the dissemination of the international standards of TB care. They have been pilot tested in a few countries, but now we need to go to other countries and disseminate, explain, discuss with other providers in order to convince them to apply the international standards of TB care. And just disseminating will not do the job. We really have to convince people to do it. But I'm quite optimistic because it has been produced by international consensus, and the ATS is highly respected by, for instance, specialists in developing countries. So it's a very, very powerful tool, and I'm very optimistic that it will work. Then the next step would be to include the ISTC in pre- and in-service training in the medical schools, in the nursing schools, etc. Then what needs to be done is an implementation guide for ISTC. What are the steps for dissemination? What are the steps for implementation to do it, to change the behavior of the other providers? Another last activity is the hospital linkage, the public-private mix with hospitals, which is mainly an issue in China, where hospitals play a very important role, and also in Indonesia, in providing care to patients. There will be a postgraduate course tomorrow on hospital dots linkage in this event. And there's also a plan to develop operational guidelines for hospital linkage. Early next year, there will be a workshop in Asia where we will gather all the evidence base from hospital linkage activities and come up with a good guidance document and operational guidelines for hospital involvement. The last thing, that the PPM needs to be monitored and evaluated regularly. PPM should be assessed in every country review. PPM indicators that are now being developed need to be implemented so we can measure, evaluate, monitor what we're doing so we can adapt our strategies. There needs to be done some operational research on issues that have not been solved yet. For instance, the cost effectiveness has been proven in 3 countries, but we have to look at other settings. Is, for instance, involvement of private practitioners a cost-effective approach? TBHIV, public-private partnership in DOTS Plus, for instance, that are very important issues. And last but not least, all the experiences, all the evidence has to be documented and to be used for advocacy, but also to learn from it and to expand public-private partnership in order to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. I'm sure NTPs will not be able to do the job alone. There are many more providers that can support programs. Even informal providers can support or strengthen the health system by doing tasks that cannot be done by the NTP. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Yan. Thank you very much. May I invite now all the speakers on the dais so that we can have some question-answer session. You have another 15 minutes.
It's everywhere.
Thank you.
Yes, please, it's open for discussion. Any suggestion, any question, clarification? Yes, yes, Dr. Shalu.
I'm Shalu Puri Kamle from the World Economic Forum. Thank you, all the speakers, for touching up on all the issues that are really close to my heart. While on whether it's the PPM initiatives or the ACSM work or the patient's charter or whatever, I think it's really important that we as external agencies are maybe in the capacity of implementing pilots, replicating them elsewhere and scaling them up. But I think it's really important that they get institutionalized by the public sector. And I see that as a big challenge in all the work that I've done in the past few years on PPM and now with the business sector. But it's really essential that the public sector institutionalizes those lessons that we learn through the pilots that are done by external agencies. Thanks.
Parvez Tufail from Pakistan. And first of all, I want to thank the organizers because I'm seeing lot many community representatives which were missing last year. So lot many congratulations to the organizers. I have lot many points to discuss, but I will spare many points and just ask Dr. John first. With reference to the PPM, I think the missing link is the informal health practitioners. In our country, we have lot many so-called fake, like traditional, but traditional practitioners, and lot many people are attending and going there, and they didn't know about the TB, particularly the these traditional health practitioners, and there's no data including in that. And the second question, it's not a question, it's a comment, like with reference to the patient empowerment and involvement, there are a lot many approaches going on. And my question is, anybody can respond, particularly if Case want to respond on that. We are having different approaches to involve patients at global and national level. And we are having discussion on grassroots level, like top-down approach and bottom-up approach. So both of the approaches have their good and bad. And which is the effective? As far as our experience is concerned, we want to have more involvement of patients, especially the TB patients and community involvement. And the link is the missing, especially at the country level. It might be good if somebody from other panelists can reflect on, is there any strategy to involve patients and grassroots community at country level to share their commands, particularly at the policy level, at the national TB control program level. Thank you so much.
I think I fully agree that I think there's a major challenge in involving the informal providers. First of all, due to big numbers, and secondly, to the fact that they are unorganized. I think there's no recipe. That the only thing that we have is experiences from pilot projects like in Bangladesh, where, for instance, the village doctors are involved in suspect identification and also treatment, that this will give us the tools and the guidelines how to continue, how to scale up involvement of the informal providers. In many countries, they play a very important role in within the TB control program, and they could also help us solve the human resources crisis that we have in the government programs. They are people that are willing, that are motivated, but they do not have the skills. So if we would learn from the experience that we have in several countries and also could identify the tasks that these providers, these informal providers, could perform to support the NTP, this would help us in solving this human resources crisis.
If I could maybe respond to your two points, Pervez. I think that when one talks about, for me, when I'm listening to somebody like Jan Voskens, I'm interested in thinking, when we're talking about public-private mix, it sounds a bit strange. I'm interested in, does that really mean engaging all providers? And I'm conscious, sitting next to Dr. Choan, that an initiative that my own little organization is involved in the Urban Dots program in Hyderabad, which Dr. Choan and the National Program Stimulator was started these pilot programs in four Indian cities. The thing that has impressed me most in Hyderabad about the project is that it hasn't been focused just on how do we get a few more DOTS providers, and it hasn't been focused just on how do we get a few private practitioners involved. It's been also on identifying and involving literally all providers. And that means, for example, in the public sector. The public sector is amazingly rich in clinics, certainly in the Indian context, other than in the national TB program. There are TB clinics, but there are also railway services clinics, there are social care clinics, there are all sorts of different networks of clinics, and all of these, as well as the voluntary sector, need to become engaged. Secondly, your second point, in terms of patient involvement, I think one strong thing I would say, which I didn't include in my initial presentation, is that I think that we are increasingly seeing more and more patient advocates and representatives present in our international gatherings, and we are increasingly seeing opportunities for what is loosely called capacity building, training, increasing understanding of how to get things done as an advocate. But what I am still not really seeing is much in the way of resources to be able to assist community and patient groups to actually do any advocacy in their own countries. And that, I think, there is a severe lack of resources. We can train people to do the job, but unless they're resources, they're not in a position to actually do the job. And that would be my main response back to you. But other than saying that the particular issue of informal sort of volunteer DOTS providers and such like community participants assisting in the process of helping patients through the long months of treatment, again, that for me is a standard and normal part and is something that very much community-focused initiatives can provide and a very important supplement to what the normal national program on its own can supply.
Just as a supplement to what the chairman, as you say, has said, what's probably not happened to our satisfaction is documentation of various experiences from countries. And as Jan was presenting, he said there seems to be a lack of trust to push forward this PPM. There is also inadequate documentation. For example, in Uganda, we have the traditional healers association, basically formed on a bid to combat HIV/AIDS. But they quickly came on board and they are members of the Uganda Stop TB Partnership, originally operating in 10 districts. Now operating in 17 districts, playing a fundamental role of suspicion and referral of suspects, because it was recognized that a majority of the clients, TB clients, first report to these extremely popular health workers. The second group was studied along with the piloting of the community-based TB care, the DOT strategy, in one district. They were brought on board right at inception and oriented as to what we do in so-called TB control. And they clearly admitted that they see a lot of these chronic coughers, and they took on the role of referral. And that district has sustained over the last 8 years a high treatment success and a high case detection rate. So what he calls the informal sector needs to be recognized. But probably the countries will need what is exactly the last tool which is supposed to be produced, guidelines on how to map out the existence of other providers. If this is done, then they will be able to quickly and appropriately engage the informal sector.
Any other question or suggestion? Yes, please. Yes.
Yeah, Alistair Reid from UNAIDS. I know that, or it's clear that most tuberculosis in the world is occurring in people who are not HIV infected. Yet a large proportion of the activism and community engagement in tuberculosis is coming from the communities that are co-infected. However, this issue is hardly touched upon at all in the ACSM Working Group strategic plan and hasn't really been discussed here. How can we build advocacy and activism for TB that doesn't increase the stigma for those who are not HIV infected, yet also deals with these very real issues and fears of TB amongst the amongst people living with HIV?
I mean, I think that you touch on a very real issue, and I think that it is an issue which we talk about, but I don't have an easy answer to you. That is to say, I am very conscious there are many parts of the world from which we do not have patient activists who have had TB as opposed to TB and HIV. And I think that such people, there are plenty of such people, there are such activists, but somehow, I think it's something that we are working on, and I think and I hope that that's something perhaps that will be discussed in the TAG meeting tomorrow, because I think that, you know, many of us are conscious that on one hand we're extremely grateful for the kind of extra additional energy which has come to us because of co-infection, and that there are, you know, many of the best advocates we know are people who come out of the world of co-infection of HIV and TB. But on the other hand, as you say, that leaves out at least two-thirds, three-quarters of the TB world. And, you know, there are many parts of the world where co-infection, happily, is not yet a major issue. But I don't have a very good answer to you except to say, yes, I think many of us are aware of it as an issue, but if you've got some good ideas on how to respond to it, tell us more.
Join the club. Thank you. One more question. Yeah.
I'm Gabby from Action Program in Nigeria, a PEPFAR-funded program. My question and remark is to do with the continuing question of limitation of resources for ACSM and many of the activities that we've talked about. I worry in the simple sense that I look at TB-HIV coordination, and one of the key activities is joint planning between the TB group and the HIV group. But I can still see like a kind of congregate staying everybody in his own position. It's like I can see in many situations where there are a lot of resources in the HIV network that is seemingly not being engaged in the fight for TB, because for dual infections it's one patient that has two diseases, and the HIV group almost globally still plans for ACSM with a lot of things not talked about on TB. And I look at this as a big opportunity for the TB group. I prefer to look at it as the same group that has the same problem. Even though there's a big number of people that are not necessarily dually infected, but the resources that are available can still focus on the two groups because they have to be protected from contacting HIV. So they fall within the same group, and this is a big opportunity for us to tap.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you. I want to come back to the involvement of all care providers. And I think, Francis alluded to the implication of the traditional healers, and there are a number of projects that try to involve those informal care providers or these traditional healers. And unfortunately, very few of these experiences are documented and written. And I think it, I want to make a call to all people in this room to try to document and to share these experiences. Some of them are very interesting. Others are complete failure. But I think both of them needs to be documented, written, and shared so that we can advance this agenda.
Thank you very much for this suggestion. And I think that will help other countries if you have some documentation on the involvement of these. Because in what capacity they are involved? For example, it's Dr. Paul was talking about the PPM project in Hyderabad. Here what we are doing, these traditional healers, when we talk about the involvement, yes, they are the important force in the community. People have faith in them. So they're going to those traditional healers. Why not to use their hold on the community and then make them dot provider? It depends upon in what capacity they can be involved. They can be involved as the advocate in the community, and they can be involved as the dot providers. And that's what we are doing in different countries. But there's a need for documenting that so that we each other can be benefited from those documented efforts, and then can be replicated in other countries also. I think it's time now. I would like to thank all the participants and speakers, and we'll break for tea, and quarter past four we'll assemble again for the last session. Thank you.
We need your presentation.
Which one?
This one? On the computer here.